Welcome, and thank you for listening to this recording, part of the Comprehensive Opioid Abuse Program, or COPE, podcast series. COPE provides financial and technical assistance to states and units of local and Indian tribal governments to plan, develop, and implement comprehensive efforts to identify, respond to, treat, and support those impacted by the opioid epidemic. Since 2017, BJA has supported innovative work on these COPE sites across the nation. Funding and programmatic support for COPE is provided by the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance, or BJA. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Hello, and thank you for listening to this BJA Comprehensive Opioid Addiction Program podcast. My name is Amanda Auerbach. I'm a consulting administrator at TASC Center for Health and Justice and will be facilitating today's podcast. As the national opioid crisis continues to grow, communities across the country are exploring innovative approaches to respond to this epidemic and save lives. Quick response teams, or QRTs, are one such approach. A QRT is an interdisciplinary, collaborative, and systemic community response to prevent opioids and respond to subsequent opioids by connecting individuals with critical substance use disorder services following an overdose. I'm pleased to have Dan Malloy joining us today to talk about quick response teams. Dan served Coleraine Township, Ohio for more than 28 years, starting as a police officer, then chief of police, before becoming director of public safety, overseeing both law enforcement and fire department in Coleraine Township. Dan's last position in Coleraine Township was serving as CEO administrator for the township until his retirement in 2018. Dan is a national presenter on the subject of community heroin and opioid response and was a leader in the development of an innovative police, fire, and addiction specialist partnership as a proactive effort to save lives, the quick response team or QRT model for pre-arrest diversion. QRTs are now active in communities across Ohio, West Virginia, North Carolina, and Indiana, and continue to grow. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's an honor. I'm happy to be with you.
Great. So just to start us out, I'll ask that you please describe for listeners what the QRT model entails and say a little bit about why Coleraine Township decided to develop this program.
Absolutely. The quick response team is it was originated after the 2013 International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference in Philadelphia. More specifically, it was created with the idea that a partnership of law enforcement and fire and EMS would be a better response to the critical incidents such as active shooters. Specific in that conference were presentations on the Aurora, Colorado shooting and the Wisconsin shootings. And my wife's actually the one that looked at me and said, okay, the world is changing. How are you going to deal with this, Chief? And then shortly after returning home, I was promoted to the position of Director of Public Safety. And having that fire response and learning how the two could work together, that's really how the basis of the quick response team was created. Proactive life safety response, critical incident, first emergency first response, community paramedicine, Alzheimer's, special needs engagement, crisis intervention, and the heroin and opioid overdose follow-up. Those were all parts of the logic model that was created when we started with the quick response team in 2014. So it kind of started out of a law enforcement driven, how do we respond to critical incidents? And it looked at a community as a whole and all the things that we needed to be more proactive with and how could we partner the two. And then in the third piece was reaching out to the smart people, as I like to call them, the addiction professionals, to provide us with the people on the ground, on the street, that can go to the homes and meet people basically wherever they are to help bridge them from the incident, the overdose, the substance use disorder to treatment and a road to recovery.
Could you describe, please, when someone overdoses, how QRT is activated and what happens from that point?
Absolutely. as I stated, the partnership is law enforcement, EMS from the fire service, and the addiction professionals, whether it be social workers or peer recovery coaches, all that. It's actually a four-person team, and upon learning of the incident, the team will then engage the family, engage the individual, help them understand the steps. We'll conduct on-site triage. We'll assess what's the best course of treatment for them, and then start making the contacts and start making the, again, building that bridge towards treatment. And this is not, it's just not that simple, but the reality is what we learned very, very early on is the question or the answer to the question is, why do you care? Why does law enforcement care? Why is EMS here? Why do you care about me? I'm a problem child, so to speak. I'm a problem citizen. But they appreciate the fact that you come to them and you sought them out. And the families are as important as the victims in this piece. The families are lost often. The families are in need of assistance and counseling. And so it's a wide spectrum of resources that come into play, whether it's specific to the person with the substance use disorder or the families that are in need of understanding and how to work with them, because many of the times they're at their wit's end. They've lost confidence in their family member. They want to know that they're not alone and help understand what's happening and how the road looks like ahead of them, and having these professionals and working more within this community and understanding that, again, it's going to be oftentimes six or seven more overdoses incidents when the person or when they're wanting to get to recovery. They're engaged in treatment, and it's just not an easy thing to turn on and turn off. Helping educate all those involved has been a huge piece in understanding how we better serve this issue.
So with that, what was the greatest challenge? I know you mentioned education. What was the greatest challenge your community encountered in instituting this program, and how did you work together to overcome that?
Well, internal culture, internal and external, was the issue. So internally, you had to build the culture and help our police officers and our firefighters and our EMS service providers, as well as any just general workers, our parks workers and, you know, our road department workers, you know, understand that we have a responsibility to serve, and that is our jobs. And, you know, whether the needle's found at the, you know, in the park, what to do with it and how to, and quit looking at people as, you know, threats to society, and understanding that there, it is a problem. And it's not something that changes overnight, but it's a process of education. And again, we, you know, I used to get emails that, you know, criticizing me and phone calls telling me to just let them die. And, there's a big community education piece and understanding that there's a proactive side to this, and our responsibility is to problem solve. And problem solving brings a lot of people together. And that was probably the biggest piece, is bringing all the partners together, bringing the folks, the public health, the school district, the business community, the human resource professionals, the faith-based community, the media, our politicians, our police, our fire, all sitting at the table and talking this through and understanding that moving forward meant we move forward together, and not just one department and one agency deciding they're going to do something. Everything was at the table, and we did move forward as a group, as a collaborative. We called it the Corian Community Health Collaborative, and we learned that together we can make a difference, and together we can move forward. Obviously, this is a police and fire-driven outreach, but the reality is it is a community response. So it was as I retired in 18, people would tell me I was wrong, and why was I wasting resources and things of that nature. But, you know, they're not understanding the responsibility that goes along with public safety and public service. You can't just, you know, cast people aside. It's not what we do. We're there to solve problems and work with our community to make it safer and better for everybody.
So kind of along that same vein, we talk about culture and stakeholder engagement. One aspect of QRT is that there is a mechanism to share this data, so a way to notify partners when someone overdoses. Data sharing is such a hot topic. It's something that creates a huge barrier for a lot of communities. And I'm wondering how you all were able to whether it was through MOUs, how you all were able to establish a system by which all partners that needed to were able to engage in that and felt comfortable doing so.
You know, that's still a work in progress. Four years into this effort, but I'll be very honest, in the beginning, I didn't care about anybody else. My responsibility was, you know, 46-square-mile community with 60,000 people, the 240-plus first responders that we had working for us, those were my drives. I wasn't worried about what another community does because no one else was really doing anything. But as we've moved forward, and as you stated in your introduction, the fact that quick response teams are working across many different states, the need to understand what definitions, simple definitions, like what does referred to treatment mean? You know, we found as we moved through this and started talking with other communities that in its simplistic presentation, referred to treatment meant a lot of different things. For Colerain and the quick response team, it meant that you got to the door of the treatment facility, they opened the door and you walked in. That was treatment. And that was referred to treatment. But we also learned that some other communities referred to treatment was the quick response team showing up after the overdose and scheduling a date for an assessment. That was called referred to treatment. So we've learned really in the last year that it's very important for us to establish what we call down here now a common model of data or an essential model. We all start working along the same page with the same definition. So when a community out of West Virginia or Northern Ohio or North Carolina or Indiana, Kentucky or Ohio, when they say we have this many people that are referred to treatment, we know that referred to treatment means they got to treatment, not that they got an assessment or something else. So we're learning as we move along, and we're helping to educate and people understand that this is important, because as we gather information, we know we can learn more about what success looks like. You know, people used to ask me, what was success? Well, success really is at the street level, it's every individual. And when, you know, when that family member, that individual comes back and tells you that they're 8 months clean, a year and a half clean, they have a job, they've got their family, they're doing things, or it could be the guy that, you know, required two SWAT call-outs that knew you were working and showed up at your office when the QRT was operational because he knew he needed help and he was tired of being a burden. So, you know, all those things are about people. And I think that's the biggest thing that makes this successful. This is a people-driven engagement model. This is about people, and it's not specific. While the heroin and opioid crisis is today, there's alcohol. We deal with people with alcohol abuse and addiction problems. We deal with anyone under that substance use disorder headline, it fits because it's about people. And the processes and the engagement and the information and the education is all relative. So, you know, that data is huge because we want to learn as we move forward what works. And I'll give you a little example. We learned that when we engaged you, our team engaged you within 3 to 5 days of the overdose, face-to-face, more than 80% of the time we would get you into treatment. Well, if we're looking about understanding what this data tells us and what I would really like to know as we move forward, is it better at 3 days? Is it better at 5 days? Is it 90% at 3 days and 14% at 5 days? Where does that 80% come from? But the ability to collect useful data and understand the individuals and know that a person who became addicted from a surgery at age 23 and it issued, you know, prescribed Percocet is a different kind of client and needs different kinds of service and support than a person who's, you know, a 25-year heroin user and they got a batch with fentanyl and overdosed and they're ready to move forward. There's a different kind of mindset, and I'm learning that as I work with the professionals in the treatment side to understand that it helps us learn how to better serve this population so we can give them the things that they need to be successful.
Thank you. So we're actually nearing the end of our time. Before we go, final question, I'd like to ask you, what advice would you give to communities that are considering implementing a QRT program?
Don't be afraid to fail. I think that oftentimes, and I've, you know, sadly, I've you know, you hear that, why are you wasting resources? Why are you doing this? This is a population or a client base that isn't worth the time and the trouble of first responders. The reality is these folks live within our community. These families are in our community. Our communities and our neighborhoods are all affected, and good people are being taken in and lost in this disease, and people in the community look to leaders. And leaders sometimes have to think differently and be open to, you know what, this is a different, I never expected 25 years into my career have to be looking at something and saying, how do we respond to an opioid crisis? Because as the chief of police, I thought I was doing everything within, you know, street level drug work, task force level drug work, you know, proactive traffic stops, engaging all these things that, you know, we were arresting people left and right, but our neighborhoods were still suffering and crime was still occurring and property crimes are still going up. And, you know, where were we missing out? We were missing out because we were not problem solving. We were not working to solve a problem that was expected from our community for us to do something about. And, you know, sometimes things work. This was a model that, you know, again, the heroin response was just one fifth of it, but it's taken on a whole element of its own. And to learn that, you know, it's being modeled across the country is, you know, it's humbling, but it's very sad, because it means we're just continuing to struggle on how to respond to a nationwide epidemic. And, you know, don't be afraid to care. Don't be afraid to realize that they're looking at us and everyone and hoping that, you know, the people that they believe public safety is at the forefront of that we're working and we can be trusted and we care. And we have an ability through who we are to create some powerful relationships and powerful partnerships. And that's exactly what happened. You know, sitting at the table with the CEO of the Cincinnati Addiction Services Council and saying, this is my idea. This is what I'd love to do. You know, what do you think about it? And Nan Franks is the CEO, and she looked at me and she just smiled and said, Dan, I've been doing street level social work for 30 plus years. I'm going to tell you right now, this is going to work. We are going to save lives. And I said, how do you know that? She goes, I'm going to tell you, because we're eliminating a lot of the barriers. We're eliminating cell phone minutes. We're eliminating bus tokens. We're eliminating the process of traveling on a bus for 35 or 40 minutes or an hour to get from point A to point B, which is our place down here in Clifton area of Cincinnati. All the things that keep people from moving closer to help, we're eliminating, because we're going out and finding them. And that is the piece that we move forward with, is not just following up from the overdose, but actively outreach with people, because we understand who's working and who's living in our community, and not waiting for the tragedy to occur and the Narcan to be distributed and the life to be saved. We're actively engaging because we know them. And you know what? We have people that are stopping our police cars on the street. We have people showing up at the police department. We have people showing up, as I stated, during their, you know, during their shift to say, you know, I hear you're out here and I need help. And, can I bring a friend? And all these different examples. And there's, you know, I know we're short on time, but there's just in the recent weeks, an ER doctor from the University of Cincinnati Medical Center, UC Hospital, Dr. Rick Ryan, stated that, you know, the QRT is the gold standard. And here's why he believes in that. It's because it's about relationships. And he said, you know, we have a facility that we can move people from the overdose or the need, and it's like 500 feet to get them to treatment. And we have a 7% success rate. And I realized that because I learned that the QRT is built on it, relationships and engaging, because I've kind of put myself to the test, and I said, I am going to work harder on the relationship piece and work harder on the people side of this. And since I've been doing it, I want to tell you that I'm 100% successful moving people from the need to the treatment. So I absolutely believe that proactively engaging people, along with their families and their support groups, is, while it shouldn't be unique, it is something that makes a difference. And that's what we said all along, the ability to engage people, the ability to work with them and let them know that you're here for them. And when they least expect it, the people they expect the least are showing up at your front door and knocking and saying, you know what? I'm here to help you. I brought this really, really great partner to help you. And just let's work together because we care about you and we want to save your life. And to see the look on the faces, and the first guy that I put into it, he said 9 out of 10 times when we said that, it was either crying or hugging that was happening next. And this guy worked out for me, and he loved doing that. But he said when he retired, the most impact he ever had was working in the QRT, and he's so thankful that he had a chance to do that. So, you know, it's crazy, but the reality is, treating people like human beings is not unique, but it does work, and it's not expected, but it's appreciated, and I think we've shown success that way.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time, Dan. This is amazing. The program sounds wonderful, and I hope that all of you listening found something useful from this. So, again, thank you, and that is all we have for today.
Thank you. It was an honor. Appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about how COPE is supporting communities across the nation, visit us at www.coperesources.org. We also welcome your email at cope@iir.com.